Hi there, I'm Seth Juarez, and I'm in Cambridge, England. All right, I'm excited to be here. Evelina's awesome, and I love machine learning and F sharp. I hope she's home. Evelina,
oh, hello.
How are you? It's so
Come
good
in.
To see
yeah,
you.
Nice
it's good to see
you.
How's everything going?
Oh, very well. All right. Well, how are you doing?
I came here because you are an a sharp person and a machine learning person, two of my favorite things, and so I was hoping you could help educate me.
Yeah, I'd be happy to help.
Let's do it. I am so excited to learn this stuff because, like, maybe some of you don't know, I'm a college dropout and I love machine learning and I want to learn some F sharp, so hopefully she has some good stuff for us.
So, Seth, I heard you want to learn about machine learning.
Oh my goodness! Look, this was my first book, and when I saw Bishop the first time, I had like a fangirl moment because I was really excited. This book was my first machine learning book.
This was my first machine learning book as well.
Oh,
so
fantastic.
This is my favorite.
And
so.
Then we have a whole bunch of other ones. Do you know any of these people? Because it looks like these were done at Cambridge.
Yeah. Well, I knew this person, and I know this guy who wrote this, and I met people who wrote this. So. That's the great thing about Cambridge.
I know, I'm so excited. And then how these books are, like, are they like $1,000? Because these books in the US are very expensive.
Well, not that much. Just go to the Cambridge University bookshop and buy them.
I'm excited. Alright, well, let's get started. Why don't you come and show you what you got?
So you start learning the books.
Yeah, I'll start with these. And then you'll show me these, okay?
And then we can talk.
So what do we got going on here?
Well, I was playing recently with some Stack Overflow data.
Okay, which is huge, right?
Yeah. Stack Overflow actually allows you to download their entire data dump, which is amazing.
Okay.
So thank you, Stack Overflow.
Yeah.
And I downloaded the data and I started playing with it to see something about the F-sharp community or about programming communities in general.
Mm-hmm.
And I put it into Azure Notebooks,
Okay. Which
I think is a very nice way of exploring data interactively.
So what's Azure Notebooks for those that don't know?
Well, it's normally it's Jupyter Notebooks.
Okay.
Jupyter actually stands for Jupyter, for Julia, Python, and R.
Oh.
But in Azure, you can create notebooks by basically creating a notebook. Let's call it a demo.
Okay.
And now we can start a language.
Oh.
And we can use either Python, R, or F#.
Is F# a new addition or has it always been in there?
It's a new addition.
Oh, that's awesome. Okay.
So it was originally a community effort to create iF# notebook.
Okay.
And now it has been integrated in Azure Notebooks as well.
So is this for exploring data mostly, or is it for doing models, or what is it for?
I think you can do basically anything in there.
Okay.
Because you can download the notebooks locally and work with them. And
Okay. The
only difference is that you are working in a browser.
Okay.
Basically, and you are typing in code and you see the results directly underneath.
Oh, let's see.
So if I do... So now I'm typing F# code and I will evaluate the cell and I should print the result. And you see, we got one.
Oh, I see. So if as you're exploring your... Because some of the things when I'm doing machine learning is I'm sitting there typing stuff and then I run it to see what happens and I have a printout. And then, so this will just do it for you.
Yeah, and the great thing is that when you run it this way, you look at it after a month and then you actually see what you are doing because you see the results directly underneath.
Well, because I mean, usually when you're running your code and you haven't looked at it in a month, you're like, who wrote this garbage?
Yeah, exactly. What does it even do?
What does it even do? All right, so tell us about the Stack Overflow stuff that you were looking. What were you?
Yeah.
What was the question you were trying to answer?
Well, I did several things. Well, let's close this notebook. Mm-hmm. Close and halt.
Okay.
Yes, I want to leave the website.
Oh, you push stay.
Oh no.
Yeah, we gotta push leave.
Oh,
there you go.
There I am. So the first thing that I actually looked at, another great thing about Azure Notebooks or about Jupyter Notebooks in general is that you can mix and match code and text.
So you can literally explain what you did and show the code.
Exactly. So here I am explaining what I did.
Uh-huh.
You can even put in equations.
Is this like LaTeX or something?
Yeah. If I double click on it, it goes into Markdown.
And LaTeX built
yes.
in.
Yes.
Oh with my LaTeX. Goodness. So it's like you're really writing, like, this is how papers should be written.
Yes.
You know, with here's the formula and here's the code. Yes. I love this.
So now I can compile it and it goes back into like nice visualization.
That's amazing.
So I will first download dependencies because that takes a little bit of a while.
And Packet is like NuGet but for F Sharp, right?
That's not really true.
Tell me, because I've got it wrong. I want to know the difference.
So you can get packages from NuGet,
sure.
right? And Packet is a package manager that you can use to download any packages from NuGet or even from GitHub.
Okay.
And it works for F#, it works for C#, it works for any .NET project.
I see. So the difference between Packet and NuGet is that NuGet only has the NuGet repository and others that are similar to it.
Yes.
But with Packet, you can create packets that download directly from GitHub.
Yes. So it's really nice.
She's laying down the knowledge. All right. So you're installing a dependency. Then.
Yes.
Okay.
I think it's finished. Hmm? I hope so. So let's run this, and you see the result is that it loaded everything.
Awesome.
And yeah, here I pre-computed some values from the gigantic Stack Overflow datasets.
Okay, and this is somewhere on Blob storage, right?
Yeah. It's hosted on Azure.
And it looks like you're using a data provider.
Yes, I'm using a type provider.
Type provider. Yeah.
Type provider.
Yeah.
So type providers are these great types in F# where you basically create a typed access to any data type of storage.
Mm-hmm.
So here I'm loading a CSV file. See, it's a CSV file. So I'm using CSV type provider, which gives me typed access to the CSV file.
And what does that mean? Like type access, like it knows the columns?
Yeah, it basically looks at the beginning of the CSV file and infers what the columns are, what are their names, what are their types as well.
Dang. So, I mean, usually, for those that do other languages, which we will not mention, usually you would have to parse the CSV file, you would have to read the columns, then you would have to check the types of all of the things in the list, and then...
Okay. And the great thing, we have type providers for JSON, mm-hmm. for SQL databases even,
Fantastic.
For almost anything.
Okay.
So, it shouldn't be highlighted in red, mm-hmm. but I think it just sometimes it takes a while until everything loads into the
sure.
notebook.
Sure.
So here I was just looking at the number of rows.
Okay.
And it's 3,000.
Okay. What is that arrow? Is that an operator?
Oh, this is just a fancy font. It's basically a vertical bar and
larger
sign.
And it just makes it look like that?
Yeah.
That's pretty.
So it's basically creating ligatures for code.
Is this something that the F# people put into the notebook so it looks like that?
Yes.
Okay.
It's a font called FiraCode, mm-hmm. and it creates sometimes things like not equal. It changes it to a non-equal sign. Larger or equal, it changes it to the larger equal sign.
See, with LaTeX and with all of this involved, like, I don't know why people don't stay. I could read these papers really easily. Because when I used to read papers, it's like, okay, I got to read the summary, and then I got to read the conclusion, and I had to do it in this order. And then I had to read the middle and figure out what their notation was. It was just, well, you know this better than I do. Okay.
So, yeah, now it caught up, and now we have everything. So I can even look at the data. So I will explain what the data actually mean. But you can see that I have autocomplete here.
Oh my goodness.
And I can even do seek.map. And I'll put in a lambda function. And if I
do it does the arrow too.
Yeah. If I do x dot, you see now these are the columns that I have in my CSV file.
That's nice.
And it even tells me that tag is a string and the weekend ratio is a decimal.
Nice. And what is this data? This is the data of people working on the weekend?
Yeah. So what I was looking at from the Stack Overflow data, I decided to look at when are people asking questions and when are people answering questions and commenting on Stack Overflow questions.
Okay, cool.
And my assumption was that if people are using something at work, then they are asking questions during weekdays, Monday to Friday.
Uh-huh.
And if they are doing something for fun or just to explore something, they are doing it on the weekend more.
Oh, and you wanted to see what languages were being used for fun
and which ones are
for
more
work
related.
Yeah, got it.
So this is my very complex equation here. So the weekend ratio, or weekend index, how I called it, is the average number of posts for a specific tag on a weekend divided by the average number on a workday.
Okay.
So the higher it is, the more questions people ask on weekends.
I see, because if it's one, right? If it's one, that means that the ratio of per week to weekend is the same.
Yes.
And then so that number, the closer it gets to one, the better it is.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or the more people play with it during their free time.
Mm-hmm.
So this basically tells you which technologies are hot. That means people want to experiment with them and play with them.
Oh, okay. That's awesome.
And which ones are very, very enterprisey and no one touches them on a weekend when they can avoid that.
I see. So you're literally looking at, as a programmer, if let's just say Sue is really excited about this language, Lua, because she does game scripting. You would never see Lua program during the weekday at her normal job.
Yes.
I see. That's awesome.
So I loaded some more data. And we can even explore the data here using the tag providers. And this just gave us like first 10 rows from the file.
So are you just writing Shift Enter to get the data?
Control Enter.
Control Enter. Okay.
Every Control Enter evaluates each cell in the notebook.
Got it.
So here you can see that C#. The weekend index is 43% roughly. Mm-hmm. That means there are about 43% posts on weekdays compared to weekends.
Got it. Yeah.
So we can compare some specific languages. So here I just printed F#, C# and R.
Okay.
And you can see that F# is actually the most weekend language out of them.
Oh.
That means more people play with F# during their free time than they play with C# or R.
Okay.
And here you see I'm again using the type providers and basically just pulling data from the CSV file.
So you're getting all the rows, you're mapping each tag and each row.
Yeah, I'm just mapping that from a decimal to a float because that's nicer for printing. And then I'm creating a dictionary, which will allow me fast lookup of languages.
Okay.
So now I can do weekend ratio. And I can just give it any language, let's say Python. And if I print it, let's call it Python. I'm not sure if that's the right tag, but yeah, you see Python has 60%.
And so it looks like Python and F# are more used on the weekend than they
people are. People ask more questions and interact with the languages more on the weekend than with C# or R.
Which makes sense, because when I want to hack something together, I'm usually in Python or F#.
Yeah,
right?
So, and then I decided to look at the most weekend technologies and the most weekday technologies.
Okay.
I looked at only the tags that are used quite often. That means they have at least 5,000 posts with them. So what's your guess? What's the most weekend technology on Stack Overflow?
I'm going to guess it's F#.
Ah, no, it's Minecraft.
What? Oh, I see. Because I was considering only things that are like programmery things, but Minecraft is the most weekend technology.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
The second one is Lightweight Java Game Library. And SFML, it's a simple and fast multimedia library that people use to actually program games as well.
Okay.
And then there is D language and Pygame.
Isn't D like some C derivative?
I'm not even sure, to be honest.
But it looks like the majority of the weekend things are gaming types.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, which kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
So what's your guess? What's the most weekday thing?
C#.
Oh. We're way off.
Oh, no.
It's SQL Server Reporting Services 2008.
Oh, my goodness. And then Infragistics, SSRS, and so just like the kind of like real
enterprise-y
like
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah.
I see.
So you see, it makes sense intuitively even. Mm-hmm.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So then I decided to compare some technologies basically visually and do some plotting.
Mm-hmm.
So in the F-sharp notebooks, we use Plotly usually for plotting.
Okay. And what's Plotly based on?
It's JavaScript library.
Okay.
But it, you can use it from Python, you can use it from R, and you can use it from F-sharp as well.
Cool.
Mm-hmm. Now so, I'm just waiting for everything to evaluate.
So the thing that you're going to be doing then is you're going to be comparing a lot of these languages.
Yeah.
Okay.
To just see how they compare. So here I decided to compare functional languages.
Okay.
So F-sharp, Scala, Clojure, Haskell, mm-hmm. Erlang, OCaml, and M.
And that's the ratios that you're looking at.
Yeah. So the higher, the more weakened it is.
Okay.
So you see Elm is the most weakened language out of them all.
Interesting.
So that's the language people like to play with.
Uh-huh.
It's a very friendly language, so I'm not surprised.
I've never looked at Elm.
You should. Well, you can look at F-sharp instead and use the... have you heard about Fable?
No, what's that?
That's basically a way of compiling F-sharp code into JavaScript.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
And we have some basically Elm-inspired frameworks for Fable, where you can write things in the Elm style, which is very nice and very functional, but in F-sharp, and then just compile it into JavaScript.
I feel like I need to be writing this down. Are we recording this?
I hope so.
Oh, yeah, okay. All right.
And the second most weekend is actually Haskell. So...
My advisor.
Other people who want to do something functional and they feel like they should be doing Haskell, they usually do it in their free time.
My advisor.
Based on my data.
Wrote a book called Yet Another Introduction to Haskell or something like that. It's really good. He loved Haskell, so this is cool.
Yeah. So actually, F sharp is quite enterprisey
mm-hmm.
among functional languages.
Mm-hmm.
But it's more fun than Scala and than Erlang.
I looked at Erlang one time and my head was hurting after I understood like how it was...
It's a very different concept.
Very different, yeah. But it's been around forever.
Yeah.
Okay.
But Erlang is actually the most enterprisey out of these languages that I was comparing here.
Okay. And by enterprisey you mean...
That more people ask questions on weekdays compared to weekends.
Got it.
So then I decided to create some nicer plots as well. So this is like a better Plotly plot.
Mm-hmm.
Where I even have a bar for the or a threshold for the one ratio.
Mm-hmm.
It means if it's over one, it means people are asking more questions on a weekend than they are asking during weekdays.
Got it. And Elm was the one that...
Yeah. And now we can compare even data science related languages, for example. So now I just put in some various languages. So F-sharp seems to be quite a lot of fun among all these languages.
Uh-huh.
People are asking more F-sharp questions on weekend than they are asking R or Python questions.
Okay.
And the most enterprisey or weekday languages or technologies, SAS and Excel.
Excel.
If you are doing any serious data science, you shouldn't be using Excel anyway.
Mental note, kids. Okay.
And Julia is the most weekend out of them.
That's awesome.
But if you look at this, you see that they are all around 0.6.
Yeah,
0.5. And all these languages are actually above that, which means that people who are doing functional programming are actually spending more time programming on weekends than data science people.
Interesting.
So maybe they should get some life.
Maybe they're tired of all the data, the garbage data they're from.
Yeah. So here I compared some random languages. Do you want to see something? What's
yes.
your favorite thing? Or what's
you're
interested in?
Let's see. Let's do machine learning. Is machine learning in there?
I don't think that's
languages, right?
This is just tags from Stack Overflow.
Oh, okay.
You know, when you have a question on Stack Overflow, it usually has tags for what it's about.
Let's do JavaScript.
I'm not sure it's the right tag. Yes, it is. Hmm? JavaScript is actually 0.5 almost precisely.
So that means that it's a good mix between weekend and weekday?
That means people are asking about half of the questions on weekend than they are asking on weekday.
I see.
Yeah.
I see. Let's see. Can we think of another one? We have... let's do Python.
All right. Python here. It's about 0.6. So people probably enjoy doing things in Python more than they are enjoying JavaScript.
The data tells them. Yeah, so Python is more fun than JavaScript,
according
to me. All right, is there anyone you can think of that's totally up at the top? Like that's close to one?
Well, We had the Minecraft that's larger than one. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what else.
Let's put Minecraft in.
Yeah, just to have the comparison here. Way above.
And so you could literally go and explore all of this data just right here on Python notebooks.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
And you see that I just changed the code, evaluate it, and I get the result directly underneath.
And is it's remembering everything that it pre-computed before, correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
And the great thing is, when I look at it later, I can see, I was doing this. But also, right now it's hosted in Azure Notebooks, and this is public, so people can go and play with it themselves.
Really? But would they be editing your stuff, or they just copy?
No, they basically fork it.
I see.
So when I look into my Azure Notebooks, see, there are 21 clones of this particular set of notebooks.
Holy cow. And can you see what they've been doing with it?
Yeah, I should be, because if you don't prohibit it, it's all public.
Wow.
So you can see all these people basically looked at the notebooks and tried something out.
That's amazing. And so if you're a data scientist or just curious about data, you can put something into a CSV, slap it onto blob storage, and use Python notebooks, hopefully with F# to explore your data.
Yeah, exactly.
That's amazing. And how long has this been out?
Well, it's still in preview.
Oh, I see.
But you can see it's very usable already.
Mm-hmm. It's very nice.
Yeah.
Well, this has been super helpful. I'm gonna read all of these books, but I really want to go see Cambridge.
Yeah, let's do that.
Because one of the things is, tell me about Cambridge. It's like a really old school, right?
Yeah. Well, it's very humbling because sometimes you can even see Stephen Hawking in Cambridge.
I will literally wet myself if we see Stephen Hawking.
Well, I've been living here for 6 years and I've seen him 2 times. So it's not very likely.
2 times. That's like more than I will ever see the man. Come on. Well, shall we go?
Yeah, let's do it.
The weather's really nice. What did you do?
We are really lucky.
Is it usually like this?
Oh, no, not at this time of year, definitely. So let's explore Cambridge.
Let's do it.
It's a beautiful place.
Is it this way, that way?
That way is the center.
All right, let's go. All right, Evelina. So we are going to go do something on water, is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
What is this?
Well, it's called punting.
Okay.
And you basically get into the boat, and one person has a gigantic pole, and they are pushing the boat while standing in there.
It feels dangerous to me. Like, am I going to
fall? Don't worry.
You're not going to push me in or anything?
Well...
It's really famous here to do this, though, right?
Yeah, people sometimes do that.
Do you know about the history of this, or...?
Well, this is a very traditional thing to do in Cambridge and in Oxford.
Okay.
I know about one other place where they do this, but it's in Germany, but it's another university town.
I see. We don't want to talk about that.
So it's traditional for Cambridge and Oxford, but in Cambridge and in Oxford, they do it different ways. So here we'll be doing it the Cambridge way.
Okay. The correct way, of course. Oh, the correct way. So it looks like it's a paddleboard kind of thing, but with a pole. Is that right?
Yes, yeah. And you are pushing against the bottom of the river.
Propelling
the boat forward.
All right, well, hopefully I don't fall in, okay?
Don't worry.
Let's do it. I'm going to fall off here. All right. So I'm punting in Cambridge. I feel like I should be helping. I feel bad that I'm making a pregnant lady punt me around.
Well, now you see that if a pregnant lady can do this, anyone can do it. No, we have one of the bachelorette party boats.
Oh my goodness. They have a weird balloon over there. Did you bleep that out video wise?
I'm in a pixel.
All right, I feel like it's my turn. All right, here we go.
Good luck.
Oh geez, I am gonna fall on my face. I don't even wanna stand up there.
Careful, we are headed for a collision.
Oh shoot. I don't want to stand up there. I swear I'm going to fall in. This is going to be ridiculous.
But you are doing a good job so far. We are moving forward.
I'm on the complete wrong side, aren't I? Oh my gosh.
You are trying to fund the Oxford way. That's
I just got called an Oxford boy in Cambridge. This is like the biggest insult you could give me, right?
Yes.
If I fall in, I'm going to be here. Hold my phone. Oh, shoot. I need this. Oh, shoot. This is not as fun as I thought it would be. Like, seriously, like the pregnant lady's doing a lot better than I did. Okay, this is really sad.
You are moving forward. Are you enjoying yourself?
Yes, yes, this is great. They've swapped me out. And another F-sharp MVP, Tomas, who people may or not. There was a whole gaggle of F-sharpers here. Did you guys put out a bat call or something?
Yeah, yeah, you just shine a specific light under the
into
sky.
Into the sky, and they
all
assemble.
And all the F-sharp MVPs get around.
Like, I asked them, like, where are you from? Oh, Spain, Switzerland, U.S., Boston. I'm like, holy cow. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about, now that I feel like I'm on stable footing, what made you decide to come to Cambridge, and what was school like here for you?
Well, I wanted to do machine learning. And Cambridge is one of the best places in Europe to do machine learning.
Okay.
So I just applied for a PhD and I got in.
That's
and
it?
That was it, yes.
Well, I should apply. Did they let anyone in?
Well.
Oh, geez. So what was it like? I want you to remember the first time you stepped on campus, because obviously you had studied some data stuff beforehand,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. I did machine learning master's in London before.
Okay.
So I knew quite a lot of machine learning already. Okay. And then I came to Cambridge, and this is just a wonderful place.
So was it?
And then you hear about all the people who studied at Cambridge, and you just feel so stupid.
Like some of those books you plopped down on the table were written by people that actually are here, right?
Yes, yeah. Mm. So are here or studied here?
Studied here. So what was it? What was it like the first day when you went to class? I remember my first day at college. I went to the wrong room.
Oh, the thing is, here you don't take classes when you are doing a PhD.
I see. What do you do?
You basically just go to the office and do research.
Okay.
Because they sort of assume that you did all the classes before, doing a master's, etc. So the British system is slightly different than the US system.
But a PhD here is a PhD in the US.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
Well, shoot.
But PhD in the US is something more like a master's together with a PhD. And sometimes even together with a postdoc.
I see, I see. So you, what was your first area of research that you did when you came here?
Well, I sort of applied for a PhD into a biomedical, biostatistics department.
Okay.
So because I was interested in machine learning applied to something that's generally helpful.
Okay.
And doing biomedical research is something like that.
Okay, okay.
So I went there and basically we started working on problems.
Okay.
At the time when I started, we actually were collaborating with some biologists that were doing research on tuberculosis.
Okay.
And they had problems integrating data from different experiments together.
Oh, I see.
So I designed some methods to do that.
Oh, I see. So what was your dissertation on?
My dissertation, I can tell you the name if I remember correctly.
Okay, okay. Because you finished a year ago, right?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And I finished my dissertation over 2 years ago, almost.
Wow.
So the title was Bayesian Nonparametric Integration of Heterogeneous Biomedical Datasets.
Okay, okay. So let's start with the first word, Bayesian.
Yes.
Bayesian is a probabilistic approach to looking at posteriors and priors,
yeah,
right?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
Okay, so what does that mean? Because I said that and I try to sound super smart and use words that like people would know. What does that actually mean?
Well, basically, Bayesian statistics is probability theory.
Okay.
It's all based about probability, around probability theory, where you are looking at prior and posterior probabilities of events. And it's just a very principled way of doing statistics.
Okay, okay.
So I don't see much difference between normal probability theory and Bayesian theory.
Okay. Are you a
frequentist statistics is a different thing.
Yeah, I was like, are you a frequentist or
no,
a Bayesian?
No, I'm a Bayesian.
Okay, okay. Because they usually have gang fights here in Cambridge at night. The frequentists and the Bayesians get and they like punch each other, right? It's like Fight Club.
Most of Cambridge is Bayesian, actually.
Oh, is Oxford frequentist?
I'm not sure.
Well, they probably are.
Yeah.
Oh, jeez. So then the other thing is, you said Bayesian non-parametrics,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So what is a parameterized Bayesian model versus a non-parametrized Bayesian model?
Well, all models are in a way parametrized.
Right.
But parameter might be, for example, a mean of a distribution.
Okay.
So if you have a normal distribution, then the mean is a parameter and the variance is another parameter.
Okay.
And the non-parametric Bayesian sort of inference, it's a very specific type of Bayesian probability where you assume that model has parameters, but it has an infinite number of parameters.
So how do you work with an infinite number of parameters in a parametric Bayesian model?
Oh, you have hyperparameters, that's sort of parameters that you use for a model.
Okay.
But the infinite number of parameters basically come into in the theory.
Okay.
And given a data set, only a finite number of these parameters are actually exhibited in the data set.
And you're trying to discover what they are?
Yes.
Okay, so by non-parametric, there are parameters, but you're trying to discover.
Yes.
Okay.
So for example, clustering is a good example.
Right.
Where if you want to do clustering, that means find groups mm-hmm. in the data, then you have to specify how many groups you want to find in standard
right.
algorithms like k-means.
I see. And then if you're doing...
And if you are doing non-parametric, you don't have to do that, and it will just infer the number of parameters from the data.
That's like a Gaussian mixture model.
Standard Gaussian mixture model, you have to say, okay, I want the five
mixtures.
Oh,
I see. Mm-hmm. But the non-parametric one is you have
you
to...
You just say I want an infinite number of parameters, infinite number of mixture components,
uh-huh.
but only about five might be actually present in the data.
Oh, I see. And then finally, heterogeneous
biomedical data
biomedical
sets.
Data. So heterogeneous biomedical data sets means different kinds of medical data?
Yeah,
okay.
yeah.
Okay.
So I was working on cancer,
okay.
where, well, most of the time I was working on cancer,
mm-hmm.
where basically they take a tumor sample from a patient
mm-hmm.
and then they measure a lot of different things.
Okay.
Like gene expression, that means which genes are active,
mm-hmm.
which proteins are present in cells, what mutations are in the DNA
okay.
in cancer, and then how to integrate all these data together
okay.
into one clustering model, let's say.
Oh, I see.
So how to find groups of data that behave in the same way across multiple different data sets.
I see.
That are very different.
And so effectively you got a lot of data and you try to predict something or group something?
I was trying to find groups of patients that have similar characteristics,
mm-hmm.
that have similar type of cancer,
okay.
based off on multiple different indicators.
Okay, okay. So it feels like when you're doing, so if I'm understanding right, whenever you're doing these kinds of research, particularly in the area of machine learning, you have to become an expert not just in machine learning, but also the thing you're studying, right? Because
yes.
you had to learn a lot of biology.
Partly. Well, the nice thing about Cambridge is that you have experts in all areas here.
Mm-hmm.
So I could just go into a different department and ask a biologist.
Does this result
make sense or not?
I see. And yeah. they would usually say yes or no. And,
yeah.
and then they would tell you where to tweak it, or what would they tell you?
They would say, okay, well, this kind of makes sense, maybe. Mm-hmm. Maybe can you show if this also holds or not in the data?
Oh, that's super helpful. And so did you have colleagues in the biology department that would help you with this?
During a PhD, I had collaborators.
Oh,
and
okay.
right now, I'm doing a postdoc.
Okay.
And I'm collaborating with biologists all the time.
I see. And so how long does it take you to do a PhD here?
Well, 3 to 4 years.
I should do my PhD here and finish for once and for all. But do you think they would accept me here?
You can try to apply. What are your qualifications?
Not punting. Oh my goodness, someone's trying to kill us. So then the last thing I want to talk about is, what was the education like here for you? Did you have a really good advisor? Is there an advisor system?
Yeah, you have a supervisor. Sort of the main advisor that helps you write your thesis and helps you with the research.
Uh-huh.
But then there are a lot of incredible people around Cambridge
sure.
everywhere, so you can just go and talk to anyone,
okay.
which is the amazing thing about Cambridge.
Nice. Man, the amazing thing right now is the weather.
It's getting almost too hot, right?
I'm gonna get a sunburn. Holy cow. We are at this place called the Eagle that you said we really needed to go to, right? Yeah. Tell me about this place.
It's a very traditional Cambridge pub.
Let's stand over here. Yeah, I almost died here. So it's a traditional Cambridge pub?
Yeah, yeah. It's one of the very traditional Cambridge pubs. It was founded in the 17th century.
Oh my goodness.
And it's been in operation ever since. And it's actually the pub where Crick and Watson announced that DNA is a double helix.
Did I pause too long? Because that's amazing, right? So this is where Watson and Crick announced the DNA double helix.
And this is where probably they went to discuss things anyway.
My goodness. Well,
because they were actually working around the corner in the Cavendish Laboratory.
Which is just around the corner.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm excited to go in. Let's go.
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, so we are at the Eagle.
Yes, that's correct.
Where, like you said earlier, Watson and Crick invented the whole DNA thing. So my question for you is, we talked a little bit about how you got started, we talked a little bit about your research, and we talked a little bit about like some of the cool stuff you do now. What's in the future for you? Two things I want to ask you. What's in the future for you? And then number two, if people are interested in this kind of field, what advice do you have for them? So future, what are your long-term plans here?
Well, I would definitely like to stay in machine learning because that's where all the cool stuff is happening right now. I'm not sure I will stay in biomedical research because the cool thing with machine learning is once you know the algorithms, you can just apply them to anything you want.
Right.
Because it's still the same mathematics, you just choose a different domain.
It's true. That's true. So what advice do you have for people that want to get into this field?
Well, to get into machine learning, I think the good things are, for example, start with something like Kaggle and do one of their competitions, or they even have like example competitions. So for people who don't know Kaggle, it's a machine learning competition website where they have all sorts of problems and you basically just take their data and submit your solution and they evaluate it.
Have you done a lot of Kaggle?
Not really. Well, when I was doing my master's in London, we actually had some mini Kaggle competitions among our class.
I see.
So that was a lot of fun.
Awesome. So do Kaggle.
Yeah.
But if someone's afraid of the mathematics, I mean, what do you have to say to them?
Well, machine learning or data science in general, it's a very broad field. So if you say data science, it can mean a lot of mathematics, but it can also mean databases, for example, which a lot of people are more comfortable with. So basically just, I think my advice for people who wanted to get into this field is to find some interesting problems and then just look for methods that could work for that problem. Because to have something that motivates you, I think that basically makes everything much simpler. So the stuff I was showing you earlier with the Stack Overflow data, I think that's a good example because everyone knows Stack Overflow. Everyone uses Stack Overflow. So people know the domain and to just play with the data and get some insights from that, it's very rewarding. And once you get into the cycle, you can't never get out of it, right?
You're addicted, right?
Yeah.
I am too, it's really cool. So you're saying advice for people that want to get into this, get some data, maybe a Kaggle, maybe Stack Overflow, but just get a lot of data. And then what, ask questions about it?
Yeah, ask questions. Because, for example, in my work, I get a lot of data from biologists, and the data are extremely complex, and I don't understand it. And the biologists sometimes just come and say, okay, so please analyze the data. And I said, so what am I looking for? Yeah. So you have to start with questions.
Okay. And so have a lot of data, have some questions. And then what? I mean, like, I feel like I know what I would do, but I studied some of this stuff, not obviously as much as you have, but then what? Have some data, have a question, and then queries? I don't know.
Well, you can do even some queries and get interesting things from that, because what I was showing you before in the IPython notebook, that was just simple, just looking at some summary statistics of the data.
Sure.
That wasn't proper machine learning. Okay. So that's a good way to start with it.
I see.
And then just either read some book or look at some Coursera courses, things like that, or even play with Azure Machine Learning.
Okay.
Because they have a very nice diagram where you basically start in one place and then it asks you, so do you want to predict a continuous number or some discrete categories? And it leads you to an algorithm that you can use for that specific type of data. And then just explore more.
So explore. You mentioned grab a book. If you had a suggestion for someone to get a book on this stuff, what would it be?
Oh, my first book was Chris Bishop's Machine Learning and Pattern Recognition.
I know, I have it too.
Yeah, that's a very good book. I think he explains a lot of things very well. And it's sort of the basic machine learning. That's where the state of machine learning was about 10, 15 years ago. So it's good for the basics. And then once you know the basics, you can always build up on that.
So what would be, so you said, because that book 10, 15 years ago was when I was, like, that was like kind of newish.
Yeah.
If for me, for someone that's already sort of done some of that, what should I look at next?
Well, the next best thing right now is Kevin Murphy's Machine Learning, A Probabilistic Perspective book.
Okay.
Which is really nice. I didn't have it at home. I have it in my office.
Of course, the good book she keeps in her office, right?
And that's more up to date, and it's a bit more technical. It doesn't explain many things that well as Chris Bishop's book, but it doesn't explain a lot of things that well. But it's very, very. Like, it goes very deep into all the algorithms.
I see.
And it's a very good reference book. You want an you want a derivation of an algorithm? Look at that.
Yeah. So the name of the book again?
Machine Learning, A Probabilistic Perspective.
A Probabilistic Perspective. And then there was one that you showed me from a gentleman from Cambridge that goes into the foundations. What was that called?
It's Inference, Information Theory, and Machine Learning.
And that gets into sort of the rudiments of what's at the basics.
Yeah, it basically derives all the basics, but from a slightly different perspective. He looks a lot at like information theory, things like coding, and how does it relate to machine learning.
Awesome. Well, so, hopefully our food comes soon because I am ready to eat. All right, so the food is here. Yeah. What did you get?
Oh, I got Plugman's lunch, which is a very traditional English sort of lunch thing.
Uh-huh.
So I have some bread, some coleslaw, some cheese, an apple and a salad. And what about you?
I, of course, had to get the fish and chips. I'm really excited.
Fish and chips.
Chips. So I'm really excited. I think we should totally dig in because I'm starving.
With mushy peas.
Oh, that's right. Mushy peas. Mushy peas. And why are they called
very
mushy
traditional
peas? Because they smush them, right?
They make them in a very strange way. I don't even have any idea how they make them.
There's people outside, they take their shoes off and they stomp on the peas, is what they do, I think. I mean, it's kind of how they make wine.
Well, they taste like it, to be honest.
All right, well, let's dig in.
Sorry. Yeah.
So this is the last place you were going to show
me.
Yeah. What is this place?
This is the Cavendish Laboratory.
Okay.
This is where the physics department in Cambridge used to be.
I see.
So this is where everything important in physics over the last 200 years happened.
200
actually.
Years. That's as old as my dad. I'm just kidding. So, like, I look at that and I see Maxwell on there.
Yeah, he was the first professor here, actually.
Oh, my goodness. And so are they still doing physics here?
No. They actually moved to a different place. And since they moved, they didn't receive a single Nobel Prize.
Well, that's what they get. Well, can I just say, it's been amazing hanging out with you. It's been amazing learning about Packet F-Sharp, all that cool stuff you did on F-Sharp notebooks. It's been wonderful walking around Cambridge, doing some punting, and then having a really good meal here. So with that, I think I'm going to say goodbye and just say thanks for letting me come here to Oxford. I mean, hold on, wait, no. So what I mean is, look, listen, I know there's like a weird thing between you and Oxford and Cambridge. So I'm in Cambridge. I was just watching Harry Potter, and so I'm a little jet lagged, and then there was this thing that happened, you know, on the plane where the stewardess gave me this food, and then it didn't set really well, and I had to go to the toilet a lot. It was really embarrassing. And so I think maybe that's affecting a little bit of what I'm doing. Next on the MVP show. We are here in Gold Coast, Australia, to meet with Troy Hunt, a well-known security expert, and the dude that made HaveIBeenPwned.com.